This morning we have the privilege of hearing from Dr. Timothy Tennant. He has served as president of Asbury Theological Seminary since July of 2009. Prior to becoming president of Asbury, he was professor of world missions and Indian studies at Gordon-Conwell Theological Seminary, where he served since 1998. Ordained in the United Methodist Church in 84, he has pastored churches in Georgia and several large churches in New England. And since 1989, he has taught annually as an adjunct professor in the New Theological College in Dehradun, India. He's a frequent conference speaker around the country and throughout the world, including numerous countries in Asia, Africa, and Europe. He received his MDiv from Gordon-Conwell, his THM from Princeton, and a PhD from the University of Edinburgh in Scotland. He's the author of numerous books and articles, including Building Christianity on Indian Foundations, Christianity at the Religious Roundtable, Theology in the Context of World Christianity, and Invitation to World Missions, a Trinitarian Missiology for the 21st Century. He's married to Julie, who is also a graduate of Gordon-Conwell, who's led numerous Bible studies and is active in Friendship International in Lexington, Kentucky. They have one grown son, Jonathan, who works in Lexington, and a grown daughter, Bethany, who is serving with the Alagwa people with AIM in Tanzania. It's been my privilege over the last number of years since he became president at Asbury to fellowship with him in a group we call the Fellowship of Evangelical Seminary Presidents. And we and our wives meet with other evangelical seminary presidents once a year, right after the first of the year. And if you ask our spouses and us, it was probably one of the most meaningful times that we have together. And Timothy and Julie have become good friends, and it's a privilege to have him here at the invitation of our Department of World Missions and Intercultural Studies to bring this year's lectureship. Would you give a warm Dallas welcome to Dr. Timothy Tennant?
Thank you so much. It's a real honor to be here. I'm so delighted. I was here last on your accreditation visit. I'm so glad you made it through. Well, I never come back here. But it's great because I've always had such amazing admiration for this school, and I was afraid that by coming here on accreditation, I'd look under the hood and be disappointed. But I found that this school was all that we hoped it would be, and it's I hope that you realize what a tremendous gift it is to be a student at DTS. This is a great place. I kind of view, especially your THM tradition and kind of all this school stands for since 1924, as kind of a, you're like the bulwark against minimalistic Christianity. You know, preach the word, you know, teach truth, love well. I love it. This is great, and you should be very, very proud of it. I think that if you want to Twitter this out, this is my view of DTS. I have to keep it 149 characters, okay. That your mission is to say that reductionistic Christianity is a failed project, and it is wrong for people to acknowledge, to try to get as many people as possible to accept as superficially as allowable a gospel which is theologically unsustainable. And you represent that, and it's a great thing. And so this lecture is designed for students primarily, and I hope and pray that God uses it to help us in these days ahead as we look at the challenge of world religions. Today particularly we'll start out with Islam and then go from there. When Jesus Christ gave the Great Commission and called us to make disciples of all nations, there was no footnote there which already acknowledged and anticipated that we would not be responsible for the 1.6 billion Muslim peoples that would someday appear on the earth, today comprising around 3,500 distinct people groups. We have a long relationship with Islam that is so important for Christians, and certainly today represents one of the most formidable missiological challenges of our day. This kind of rugged frontier between Christian and Islam goes a long way back. From John of Damascus in the 7th and 8th century, in his book Concerning Heresy, particularly his chapter 101, The Heresy of the Ishmaelites, first apologetic in regard to Islam, all the way through to Raymond Lull in the 13th century, his Amasis Ars Magna, which eventually he became a martyr for the faith, one of the first Christian martyrs at the hands of Islam, and all the way to the present day. But in addition to all of the history between Christianity and Islam, you, students at DTS, have four other overlays which are really important for where you sit this morning. First of all, you have the overlay of the current conflict that's comprised much of your adult life in the Gulf Wars, in the current struggle with ISIS in Iraq, Syria, and even as we speak this morning, the attempt to take Mosul back from ISIS. The second reality is the pure demographics of Islam as a world religion. There is no doubt that Islam has been for the last century and continues to be the fastest growing religion in the world. It started out the 20th century with 199 million, ended the century with 1.2 billion, and is today around 1.6 billion. Thirdly, we see the globalization of Islam. Islam is not merely limited to the Middle East, North Africa, the Eastern Africa, on out through Central Asia, Indonesia. Islam is also now very much a part of the Western world. 10 million Muslims reside in Western Europe, at least 5 million in the United States. And so we can no longer conveniently bracket it out as a missionary problem, people who are going over there. This is a current challenge that we face in our society today. And then finally, the rise of religious pluralism, which has also framed your lives, which has become a very dominant motif in our society, and what it means for us to think about Islam in the context of religious pluralism. I'll say more about this. But certainly the fact that across our country today, there are courses in Islam that people take in virtually every university in this country, and many seminaries now offer courses in Islam and have actually lectureships on Islam and Buddhism and Hinduism at DTS. Think about it. We are in a really different day, especially since 9/11. This day has changed. This lecture really wants to reflect on Islam in light of all of these global trends and what it means for us to position ourselves in the light of where we are. And I particularly want to say this in light of the larger kind of where we are philosophically as a Western people, particularly the kind of epistemological crisis of postmodernity which we face. One of the earliest writers to recognize that we might ourselves, this generation, you, be faced with a collapse of modernity was the French philosopher Jean-Francois Lyotard in his 1979 article entitled The Postmodern Condition, A Report on Knowledge. That was the article that coined the word postmodern, the way we use it today, and started what has now been observed by dozens of writers in the subsequent years, which you know well, which has described that Western civilization is currently in a growing crisis of truth. We are in an epistemological crisis about knowledge. In the modern world, there was a belief in overarching truth, he argued, whether informed by a Christian worldview or even by a secular belief in things like progress, the perfectibility of the human experience, reliability of reason, etc. And Lyotard argued that modern societies produced order and stability by generating these grand narratives, these large canopies of meaning that gave a sense of telos and destiny. That's why Ronald Reagan could actually ask, "Are you better off than you were 4 years ago?" It was a classic line because it assumed, of course you should be. That's a society that expects things to get better. Your generation, I don't know about you, but in general, I've done surveys, your generation does not expect that their children or your children will necessarily live in a society that's better than one that you inherited from your grandparents. So this grand narrative is important. In the postmodern world, we're all on a virtual voyage, right? One explores self-created worlds. Postmodernity moves away from objective claims to reality, like preach the word, and moves to fragmented forms and discontinuous narratives. In short, the very notion of truth as truth has begun to collapse. So this is something that's actually in many ways engulfing the entire planet in various ways, but particularly the Western context or where we are today. And so the important point for this lecture is that postmodernity rejects the Christian meta-narrative just as much as it rejects the Islamic meta-narrative. That's important to remember that. I emphasize this because Islam, truly and historically understood, and Christianity, truly and historically understood, stand utterly opposed to this postmodern conception of truth. And so at that level, Islam and Christianity stand shoulder to shoulder in some ways as allies against this particular epistemological crisis. It'd be like, you know, if I can use the Brer Rabbit story, why should we continue to slug it out with each other when the Brer Fox of postmodernity is about to devour us both? Peter Berger, I think, summed it up pretty well, the situation we're in, when he said about religion and postmodernity. He says, religion for us becomes privately meaningful, but publicly irrelevant. And I don't know you that well, but at least my conception of DTS is that you would never, ever accept a situation where the Christian faith was reduced to a compartment of your imagination. We will not accept that. We're not just trying to like preserve a personally meaningful virtual voyage. We have a much bigger project than that. So what is the Islamic meta-narrative? Well, in a broad stroke, it's this, that Allah created the entire world. He revealed his will in various ways to the prophets. He finally raised up Muhammad as the seal of the prophets, to whom he gave the message of the Quran through the angel Gabriel. The Quran perfectly reveals Allah's will because the Quran represents, in their view, an exact replica of a heavenly tablet. Muhammad is therefore not only the greatest of the prophets, the seal of the prophets, he is the supreme example of what a Muslim is. That is what it means to submit to Allah. The word Muslim means one who submits. The hadith, this is the traditions, the hadith represents the testimony of this record, and along with the Quran is the basis for Sharia, the straight path to truth. In the Quran and the hadith, Allah has revealed many commands to his true followers, such as confession of faith, daily prayer, fasting during Ramadan, giving to the poor, pilgrimage to mosque, and so forth, to Mecca. So obedience to these commands creates a ummah, or a community of believers known as Islam. Now for the Muslim, these Quranic revelations are not private narratives. They are good and right for the entire human race. And every true Muslim, if you're a true Muslim, would pray for the day when the entire world would fall down and declare, there is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is the prophet of Allah. Indeed, at the climax of the ages, they believe that Allah will judge the world according to his will as revealed in the Quran. And this way, Allah will vindicate his true servants and he will judge those who resisted his will. In broad stroke, that's the Islamic meta-narrative. Now, what is the Christian meta-narrative? I don't need to do it here. But for someone who might be tapped into this outside of our community, we believe at the center of our meta-narrative is, of course, Jesus Christ. We believe in his historic incarnation. We believe in his atoning death, his bodily resurrection, his glorious ascension, and his enthroning session at the right hand of the Father. There's much more we could say, but you got it. Now, if I can take the liberty of the two meta-narratives in a single phrase, I would say that Christian narrative is at root a Christocentric meta-narrative. In other words, it's the Jesus story. It's, of course, Trinitarian rooted, but it is a Jesus story. Islam is at its root the Quranic-centric meta-narrative. In other words, it's the Quran story. You should must see that for Muslims, they themselves, I've had many conversations with them, they themselves see that the gift of the Quran to the world is from them like how we view Jesus' gift to the world. It's Jesus and the Quran, not like the Quran in the Bible, which they view more akin to their hadith. These are really the two meta-narratives, a Jesus-centered meta-narrative and a Quran-centric meta-narrative. Now, both are fundamentally opposed to the postmodern collapse, which reduces all of these to personal stories, as we've said. Now, what I would say, there's at least two corollaries to these, what we're talking about, where we are with these two meta-narratives in light of our current situation. First, neither of these religions could possibly be simply a vague disguise or a temporal mask which shrouds a deep, true religion which unites them all and us all. This is the hope of A.K. Gangadhian, who seeks what he calls, quote, the universal divine form which must live at the heart of any and every form of life. This is Karl Rahner's anonymous Christianity. No, Islam and Christianity offer too clear a vision for that. Both, for example, are rooted in historic events from their perspective. The historical revelation of the Quran to Muhammad via the angel Gabriel in the month of Ramadan is for them just as real as for us the parting of the Red Sea or the crucifixion of Jesus Christ. These are not ephemeral ideas. They're historical anchors and cannot be swallowed up in some mystical Gangadian sea. Historical events are by definition unique because they're non-repeatable. Islam and Christianity both operate on the axis of historicity, not just overarching religious ideas or themes. Now, there have been countless attempts through history, as you may well know, of trying to find a way to create a religion that can absorb all other religions into one big mass. Take, for example, the Din Ilahi religion of Akbar in the 16th century, or the Church of the New Dispensation by Keshav Chandra Sen in the 19th century, or even the modern-day Baha'i movement, which seeks to unite the entire human race and all religions together. But Islam and Christianity have both rightly resisted attempts because they have maintained their own historical particularity. Which brings me to the second observation. We cannot say these two meta-narratives are, at the end of the day, all the same. This is a form of gross reductionism. In fact, it's a double reductionism. And number one, if you try to say Islam and Christian are really saying the same thing, one of the common themes today in modern discourse and interreligious dialogue, then what you do is, you actually separate like what actual Muslims actually believe all over the world from some really weird conversation going on a stage somewhere. It's also, not only does it massively reduce Christianity to what we actually believe or reduce Islam from what they actually believe, but it's also a double problem because it also is a complete disrespect of the dignity of unbelief. We believe that people have the right to disbelieve the gospel, and you have the right to disbelieve Islam, and we don't want to be swallowed up into some kind of thing. And by the way, while we're on that, we are all close now, your generation is on the cusp of the loss of the Judeo-Christian marketplace. We get that. The public square is no longer Judeo-Christian in any kind of way that's preserved the way that we inherited years and years ago. So at this point, we really have two options. And this is what your generation is struggling with, and it has a lot to do with this lecture. One option is to opt for what is called the naked public square. All religions of any kind saying anything are pushed out of the public square. Now that would be a triumph for secular humanism, essentially. It'd be a secular atheism. That's who would be left in the square when everyone else left. The other alternative is a religious pluralistic public square. Now once you go to that option, you have two sub-options that we have to remember. One option, which is the one that's mostly done today, is the option to say, well, we'll let religious voices in the public square, including Christians, Muslims, etc., but like this last point of the lecture, but we have to find ways to say things we all agree on. You end up with what I call the Baha'i mush. That's not an official term. It's not in any dictionary. I made it up. But it is the kind of mushy world where, suddenly no one, actually everyone hates it. It actually has any kind of religious identity because you don't really see yourself in anything that's said. I've been in these interreligious dialogues or prayer, city prayer meetings or whatever, where you can only pray something that everybody can accept. That is a sickening experience. The other option is the option of what's called expressive liberty. This is where every faith is fully allowed to express their faith in the full clarity of what it is in the marketplace. This is the open market. Muslims are welcome to express their views in the open marketplace. So are Christians, so are Buddhists, so are Hindus, whatever. That is, that for Christians, bring it on. We are delighted about that opportunity. So given these realities, we are finally able to rise above the postmodern fog, have a real debate among committed Christians, committed persons that recognize real differences between Christianity and Islam. Now, having had many such conversations with Muslims, I have found there are a couple of things that are very much non-starters when you begin to have your conversation with a Muslim. Don't talk about the character of Muhammad or inconsistencies in the Quran. Those are not good places to begin. Instead, and much better actually for us all, is to focus on Christ himself. And because the Quran is so full of references to Christ, it's actually a fruitful place that both groups can start with, because Christ is the most central issue and person who separates Islam and Christianity. That is the real divide. In fact, I think it's actually more so than we really realize. Often when you have interaction with Muslims and people want to have a conversation between Muslims and Christians, they often will say, let's focus on areas of agreement, areas of like common ground is a phrase that's often used. And three examples, there are many examples, but for example, we can both agree that it's said that God is the creator of the world, because Muslims teach that, we teach that. Or the category of revelation, again, this is an anti-postmodernity. We believe in the idea of revelation, the category of it. Or even the idea of final judgment, a major theme in the Quran and the Bible. These may seem fruitful points of comparison, but as Christians, we must surely realize that the New Testament does not give us this kind of hermeneutical space to bracket Jesus out of a conversation. The Christian view is not, let me repeat it, the Christian view is not that the monotheistic religions of the world are all basically the same until the incarnation comes crashing into history and explodes the Christian worldview. Rather, for the Christian, Jesus Christ fills the whole frame. Once the truth of the incarnation is fully realized, it called early Jewish Christians and ourselves to radically rethink our past as well as our future. The book of Colossians, for example, says that it was through Jesus that the Father created the world. We can't discuss creation without Jesus Christ. It is Jesus who himself declares that all judgment has been given to him. So now Jesus sticks his nose into final judgment even. Even the generic claim, which I get all the time in these conversations, well, we can agree that Allah and God are all powerful. Surely Christians and Muslims can at least agree on the omnipotence of God. And I'll say absolutely, but let me just clarify one part about it. For Christians, God showed his greatest strength in the weakness and the vulnerability of the cross. That God does his most powerful work under a cloak of failure. It's a world the Muslims cannot even fathom. Even our understanding of God's power is different than Islamic views of God's power. Thus, everything in the Christian meta-narrative, from creation to final judgment, is now decidedly Christocentric with We Are the Jesus Story. Any discussion with Muslims on any topic, I've found, cannot probe very deeply without coming eventually face to face with Jesus Christ. It's a bit like Christ on the road to Emmaus. Christ models his centrality. He demonstrates to these monotheistic Jews how Christ was actually central to everything they'd ever known in the past, which had been revealed in the law and the prophets. So let's move ourselves to a little bit of maybe a small case study on this and see where we might go with this conversation of Christ with a Muslim. And this is where I loved it. We're at DTS, because it's a point that will just be great for you. That was personal aside there. The immutability of God. Now, the minute you begin talking to Muslims about Christ, very quickly will come either, you know, depends on what kind of person you're talking to, but either tacitly kind of comes up behind the scenes, was clearly there, or actually overtly brought out, is that they don't really believe that Christians can possibly believe in the immutability of God. The idea that God's essence cannot change. The reason is because their mentality is God cannot change, because if he changes to the better, that doesn't work, because if you're perfect, you can't get better, and you certainly can't get worse. All that's a violation of God's perfections. Therefore, Muslims see this as a major weakness and flaw in the Christian view about Jesus Christ. God cannot change, God cannot suffer, all of that. The enthronement passage in the Quran, there's 12 of these enthronement passages. Allah's on his throne, he's untouched by human suffering, pain, etc. If he does, it's the denial of the very definition of God. So the root of the Islamic objection to incarnation might be found in the Gospel of John. The Word became flesh. and dwelt among us. Now, for a Muslim, that is absolutely scandalizing. Surely, the Muslim has argued many times to us, Allah cannot become something he previously was not. That seems that it's such a clear violation of his immutability. How can God become something that he was not? Surah 112, Allah is one, eternal God. He begot none, nor was he begotten. None is equal to him. The idea of Allah being born to a human mother, growing up in Nazareth, being hungry and thirsty and so forth is utterly inconsistent. It's actually not just, we may think it's just about Allah or Christ dying on the cross, but it's even something as basic as hunger and thirst. How can God be hungry? It's just inconceivable to them. The entire objection might be summed up in the simple syllogism. We go like this. They're looking at our views from Muslim side. One, God cannot die. Jesus died on the cross. That's what we claim. Therefore, Jesus cannot be God. And that's like, close the story right there. How do we respond to this challenge? Well, this is where you need a THM. All of these questions about the immutability of God in light of incarnation are all answered in light of a proper view of the incarnation and knowing what we actually teach. And a lot of Christians don't know what Christianity teaches on this point. The Christian position is not simply that Jesus is God, but that Jesus is the God-man, the theanthropic one. He is both fully God and fully man. We must be equally zealous in defending both of these realities. When the Son of God became incarnate in Jesus Christ, Apostle Paul says he did not regard equality with God that which would be grasped, but he emptied himself and took on the form of a man. Now, we can't get into all of the canonic theories here, but the text does not mean, nor can it mean, that Jesus emptied himself of the divine nature, for that would concede the Muslims the very point that we're making. It'd be a violation of the immutability of God. Rather, it means that Jesus temporarily accepted the limitations of human nature, and he emptied himself of the free exercise of many of his divine prerogatives. This meant, for example, that as Christians proclaim, the omnipresence of God in Jesus Christ would not violate the finite limitations of the human body. God has no needs, but he accepted temporarily finite human needs of hunger and so forth, lest the humanity of Christ be violated or destroyed. Thus, in the incarnation, Jesus becomes functionally subordinate, not only to God the Father, but even to those who crucified him. However, he never became ontologically subordinate. The Orthodox Christian position is that there are two natures within Christ, the divine nature and the human nature. They are not fused or confused. They're not mixed or stirred together. They remain distinct in the incarnation. They remain distinct even though they're united in one person, Jesus Christ. This is the two natures, one person, of the Council of Chalcedon, 451 AD. And this is why we're not caught in a logical contradiction by the Muslims in the syllogism about God dying and God not dying, yet Jesus dies. The Christian position is not trapped in a logical contradiction because the two natures remain ontologically separate in the incarnation, although they function in harmony as they're united in the one person. The divine nature of Christ was expressed within the finite limitations of the human body so as not to violate the true humanity of Jesus Christ. The result is that Jesus, as the incarnate God-man, was subject to real pain, real suffering, even death on the cross. But the death of Jesus Christ on the cross refers to the death of the person, not the destruction of the divine nature. And Jesus truly died, as evidenced in the Bible, but in no way was his divine nature destroyed. Now, this mini kind of reflection illustrates two points regarding a Muslim-Christian conversation about Christ. First, Christians must know their own theology. And one of the greatest challenges we have today is the church doesn't understand what we actually teach. So they can't have it. That's why they need leaders like yourself to help them. Two, Muslims must be careful not to be so swift in their judgment concerning Christ. They have actually dismissed something that's a caricature of what we actually believe. And we need to have this conversation deeply. In my own research, I have examined every reference to Jesus Christ in the Quran and the Hadith. In the Quran, there are 39 major references to Christ, and all of them fall into five basic categories, which I'll mention briefly. Category one will be the text related to Allah not begotten or having not begotten or begetting, as in Surah 19:35 or Surah 112:3. I would include in this group any negative references to the expression son is applied to deity, like in 7:22:3. Second group includes all the shirk passages. This is the passages that say God or Allah cannot have any kind of partner. Associating partners with God is associated with our view in Surah 17:111 and many others. The third group refers to any reference to a Christian belief in a Trinity, as in Surah 4, Ayah 171. The fourth group, those texts which accuse Christians of elevating a prophet to divine status, is like in 9:30 and 31. And finally, the last group, all this condemnation of the notion of that the son of Mary would imply that Mary was entitled to worship if she was in fact the mother of God in Surah 5, 116. Now, if you examine all of these, and I'm going to put aside because of time the 41 references to Christ in the Hadith, we can discuss that over pizza. But for now, let's stick to the Quran. All of these texts reveal they are attacking positions which Christians likewise condemn. The past about Allah begetting and having a son, which we immediately read like from John 3:16 or whatever, they're actually references to physical, sexual generation and sexual cohabitation. When Jesus referred to as in John as the only begotten son, he's referring to his unique stature and of course has nothing to do with physical procreation. In short, Christians and Muslims find the notion of physical cohabitation by God offensive and blasphemous as much as anyone. The Fourth Lateran Council in 1215 stated that the divine nature, quote, does not beget nor is it begotten in reference to this point. In fact, it is a word for word quotation of the Surah 112, verse 3. Two, the shirk passages, as well as the two passages make reference to Trinity, are both either rebuking some kind of idolatry, some conception of polytheism, or in the case of the Trinity, tritheism, which Christians also reject in the most forceful terms. The idea of these texts, next category, of elevating a prophet to divine status, whether a man being made to divine status, or in the case of Arianism, that Christ was the firstborn of all creation, created at the form of creation. All of that is reprehensible to Christians and has been rejected by Christian thoughtful thinkers over the years. And finally, the concerns that Muhammad had about the status of Mary, the mother of Jesus, reflects the same reluctance that many dedicated Christians have felt throughout church history at the unqualified or unrestricted use of the title Theotokos, God-bearer for Mary. Therefore, it's important to point out that the many passages in the Quran, which if you read the Quran, I hope that you do, which strike Christians as offensive, may in fact not be a rejection of historic Christian Christology. Now, I am not saying, please hear me here clearly, I am not saying the Quran ever endorses or even has any clue about Christian orthodoxy. If you think your parishioners and are confused, you can imagine the Muslims are. I think the problem is Muhammad has either never been exposed to Orthodox Christianity or simply didn't understand it. And therefore, the Quran actually never really shoots down the historic view because it never comes into view, as it were. If the Quran is found attacking views which we also attack, it seems we now have an open door to actually discuss what Christians actually believe about Christ, which doesn't come up in the Quran. As Christians, why would we accept a position where we are compelled to defend what essentially in their minds is either Nestorianism, Monophysitism, Adoptionism, Arianism, or even Tritheism? Why would we defend those positions? We've rejected all five of them. We reject the notion of the procreation of the Godhead. We reject the idea that God had intercourse with Mary and begot Jesus. We reject tritheism, the idea there's three gods in the way that Muslims understand that. We don't believe that Jesus was a prophet that was given divine rank. We don't believe he was adopted into the Godhead or even created at the beginning of creation as the Arians so loudly proclaimed. So we should be shocked by these assumptions as much as they are. Let's get the real view on the table. This is why expressive liberty is so important in the public square. What do Christians actually believe? Let's talk about that. Every religion deserves to be heard for its actual beliefs, not caricatured or attacked for beliefs that they don't actually have. That's true for Christianity and for Islam. We live in a day where discourse has been mostly turned into caricatures rather than actual conversations that are principled about what people actually believe about things. Now, the very fact that such confusion about Christology exists in the Quran is not an indictment on Muhammad's intelligence. The Christians had not yet translated the Bible into Arabic. We made the mistake of saying, well, it's just a desert. Who cares? There was no Bible available to Muhammad to read. He was relying upon oral traditions at the time, and the presence of a number of heretical groups had already flown the empire and migrated down into Arabia. Kenneth Scott Latourette, in his first volume of his classic, A History of Christianity, points out that towards the end of the 6th century, which is the time of Islam, there were said to be 20 Monophysite sects in Egypt alone. And Egypt was a much larger entity going down into what is now Arabia, North Arabia. One form was even tritheism, which held that the Trinity taught that we've thought there really were three gods, each with different substance and natures. This, remember, Chalcedon's only 451, wasn't that long ago. And when 451, when Chalcedon was decided, they didn't have Twitter to get the message out. It took a while for church to actually, and then many that were that didn't agree with the Chalcedonian compromise were pushed out, and guess where they fled? They fled to Arabia. And so this is a big challenge we have. In conclusion, I'm convinced that there is great room for honest discussions about truth among Christians and Muslims. If we fiercely stand against the winds of postmodernity, then we can actually make our conversation very relevant. The postmodernity would make the whole conversation irrelevant. We can actually have conversations, not just about what we share in common, which is, of course, there to some limited degree, but more importantly, about boundaries between Islam and Christianity. In my view, it comes down to a fundamental difference between Jesus Christ and our views of Jesus Christ. Muslims and Christians, at the end of the day, must be prepared to stand before God on Judgment Day and say effectively, "Here I stand." After all, this is Reformation weekend. Either one has faith in Christ and who he is, or one has faith in the Quran and what it says and what it proclaims. There are two meta-narratives out there, the Quranic-centric meta-narrative and the Christ-centric meta-narrative. They both cannot be right. As for me, I take my stand with Jesus Christ, the eternal Son of God, who died, rose, ascended, and is seated at the right hand of God the Father. Thank you very much.